Grade 2 Conference, Lecture 30, Teaching the Saints, Part 2. Or perhaps I should call this Teaching the Saints or Not Teaching the Saints, Part 2. I hope that I didn't scare anybody away in that first lecture. And of course, you know, when I bring things like this, it's composite. I'm not saying that, you know, you're going to be talking to faculty members and all this stuff's going to be hurled at you. I'm talking about hundreds of people always. You know, my experiences in a large swath of Waldorf education, 150 schools in North America and more schools internationally and public and private and so on. So I'm only giving you an example of, you know, one or two of these things you may encounter, probably in a much more softened way than I'm presenting it. But just to say, it is living there. And you will now and then not so much have a colleague who kind of starts frothing at the mouth about this, but there will be parents who will get very, very upset. And on matters of, you know, how my child's being treated and things like that, parents will generally come and talk to you individually. On curricular matters, because that's what you're working with in your parent evenings, so when parents have an objection to something in the curriculum, they're going to bring it to the whole class. You know, they want everybody on their side in this sort of thing. It's not just their child who's getting damaged by this, but everybody. So be ready, and you know, I will, of course, the whole point of these lectures is not only to suggest to you teach this or that saint, but much rather, why are we teaching it and what does it speak to in the child? And before I go into that, I just want to bring up one other set of objections. And once again, as I've mentioned before and will continue to mention, this is, you know, on an entirely different level. And this is for those of you teaching in public schools, of course, where, you know, the idea of the separation of church and state, which is in the Constitution so incredibly simple and clear that it has to do with the state, with the federal government, not establishing a state religion. That's it. It's not opposed to religion and not even to there being religious streams in a school. It's just that the state cannot say, this is the state religion, as of course was the case in all European nations at the time the United States or the colonies were breaking off and the United States finally was established. So anyway, but you know, that's a matter for the courts to work out over time. And once again, you always bring this historically. Boys and girls, once upon a time, people believed that, or people told stories about a very special person who was born with the name John, but called himself later on Francis. And of course, with the fact that a pope has called himself Francis for the first time, there you have even current events and, you know, to understand what's going on in the world today and so on. There are lots of ways that you can bring these stories and justify them. Many teachers that I know of in public Waldorf schools tend to teach just two or three saints in second grade and otherwise want to bring in legends, stories of good people. And very often, the good people that they want to bring in are contemporaries. You know, I've seen teachers bringing in Cesar Chavez, the great union leader of the 20th century, California union leader for those who were harvesting grapes and other migrant workers, Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela, and figures like that. And we'll talk about that. And, you know, is that second grade material? And here again, you're going to find that many of your colleagues who've preceded you in second grade have done this and feel it is. So I don't want to, you know, rock the boat, but I do want you to just give some thought to this whole matter. So that's the third set. Well, the school district won't allow that. You know, where what if an inspector walks in? And once again, it depends on how you're teaching it and what your rationale is. And I would say that even in an independent Waldorf school, there is no teacher in his or her right mind who is trying to teach this to the children to convert them to Christianity or specifically to Catholicism. That's not what it's about, even in the independent school and certainly not in the public school. So I think we probably could be a little bit more courageous there or proactive there, but you'll have to see for yourself. Okay, now let me say more about the second grader. You know, talking about a child at any given age is just endless, even though I've spoken quite a bit already. But I brought up the fact that the second grader, very importantly, still living in the etheric radiance of the last stages of early childhood, which are going to be, you know, completely left between grades 3 and 5, but there's still enough of that radiance there that the etheric body is still very strong, but they are starting to get intimations of the coming of the astral body. And this is going to lead to the polarization, the divisiveness, the nastiness at times, the things that in the way fables are taking up. But along with the astral body, because it is polarized, along with the lower astral body, there also comes a quieter side, a side that one sort of has to look for. It's not going to be in your face like the lower aspects of it. And we could say, to use a word that is kind of disappearing from our vocabulary, the astral body also brings to the second grader a quality that we could call idealism, a sense of wanting to act out of something much higher than oneself. And this lives in second graders. It's not going to be obvious. It's not going to be something you'll see on the playground. It won't necessarily live in their social relationships with one another, because that's where the astral body, the lower side of it, gets very active and very embedded. But it will live in individual children. And the fables will not appeal to that. They're not meant to appeal to that. They're about, you know, meeting and facing the lower astral side. But it is the saint stories which are uniquely among all stories that we tell the children. It is these stories of saints that can speak to this gentle, individual, almost ineffable quality of the higher astral nature, the higher starry nature that lives as an ideal for the children. And I would say, though I have said this is not a year in which we're trying to convert the children to the Catholic Church, I'd say on another level, we don't have to convert the children to Catholicism in grade 2, because all children are Catholic in grade 2. That in grade 2, the highest, the best of which the Catholic Church is able to bring into the world, of which that church is capable and has brought, because we have things like Chartres Cathedral and the Sistine Chapel, we have the Catholic Church to thank for that. We shouldn't forget that. That quality is living in the second graders. So we don't have to turn our second grade classroom into a church, but we have to realize that that is sort of living there. And it is right in grade two for the children to have a kind of delicate exposure to the highest ideals that are embodied in the Catholic Church. And we have to remember that certainly some of the saints we're going to teach were not always in good standing with the church because they were too individualized, they were too quirky, they didn't necessarily follow all the rules and regulations which were there in the church fairly early on, but that others did everything possible, even with their incredibly nearly superhuman capacities. Other saints tried very much to fit themselves into the church and were models of devotion to the church. So we're going to see all kinds of versions of Catholicism in these various saints that we bring. And it's not that we're ever really teaching about the church or even talking about Catholicism or the Catholic Church at all. But it's good for us to realize that something of that church's qualities brings a kind of radiance into the second grade classroom. In the same way that in third grade, all children are Jewish. Jewish in the older sense, I'd say more, they're all Israelites. But this is an age in which all that the Israelites and the impulses underlying Judaism at its best and at its highest, that lives in grade three. So we really do take the children through the stories alone on a path of religious diversity and religious multiplicity in the kinds of stories that we're telling. So one wants to be aware of that as well. Now, to give you a couple of examples of this, from my own life, though I was raised Jewish, and I lived in a neighborhood that was, about half Jewish. One side of the street was all Jewish, the other side was more diverse. And the apartment building in which I lived, however, was all Irish. And my dearest friend was a girl named Annie Fitzpatrick, who came from a devout Irish Catholic family. And I'd go into her apartment to play with her, and there all over the place were images of the God that I was not allowed to envision as an image because of my Hebrew school lessons. But nonetheless, when she would share with me what it was like to go to confession, what it was like to go to Mass, what it was like because she went to a Catholic school to be taught by people who were wearing, you know, all black, very different from Waldorf teachers, for sure. It was just incredible. And so she and I decided when we were both 8 years old that she and I would grow up, we would get married, she would be a nun, I would be a priest, and we would live happily ever after. I guess we already had that kind of feeling of the ecumenical council to come later in the century, in which indeed priests and nuns started to marry one another, but not always with the blessing of the church. So that's one little story. Another is in the year 1994, a Russian film named Burnt by the Sun received the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. And this is a film written by and directed by and produced by a very remarkable Russian named Nikita Mikhalkov. And he, incredible actor among other things, But the real star of the movie is his daughter. And Nadezhda Mikhalkova, excuse my pronunciation, who is 8 years old in the movie. That was her actual age. So she portrays his daughter, and he's portraying a Russian general. It's a very powerful, very, very tragic film, but a deeply affecting film. And this little girl, as much as her father, who is a larger-than-life, incredibly charismatic, choleric individual, I mean, he's a powerhouse on the screen. She is more powerful than he whenever they're together. 8 years of age, and you see this little girl who is deeply, deeply in love with the ideals of the Russian Revolution and communism, and on the other hand, who also carries this very deeply Christian quality within her, which has to do with the sort of aristocratic family from which she comes originally. It is powerful. I have never seen in any work of art or read in any book or whatever a depiction of the 8-year-old child that is as accurate as this movie. I'm pretty sure that you could get it on Netflix or in DVD form or whatever. Burnt by the Sun, 1994. It is, I would say, required viewing for all of you about to go in and work with 8-year-olds, because it is a rare and accurate depiction of this kind of nimbus of idealism that really lives there. And in fact, the movie is punctuated again and again by the appearance of these great balls of light, which sort of come out of nowhere and appear in the most odd moments. And it's as though this is what you're going to have appearing in your class. You will have children coming up to you and saying that they wish they could have been that saint. They won't say that necessarily about fairy tale figures, and it's unlikely anybody's going to come up and say, I wish I were Joseph, or I wish I could have been Ruth. It doesn't work that way, but for second grade, it does. The children identify very, very powerfully with these saints, not again because they're goody-goody, but rather because they sense that those saints were constituted in such a way that what the second grader experiences now, the saints experienced in their adult life. And what is that? What is that quality? Well, in the next lecture, I'm going to speak about the question, who were the saints? How do we judge when we're going to tell a story of saints? You know, how do we know that we should tell the story of St. Christopher, St. Francis? And once again, what about Nelson Mandela? What about Mother Teresa? What about Princess Diana, who died at the same time as Mother Teresa and was often equated with her? How do you know? Well, what's the, you know, how does the Pope decide who's supposed to be a saint? What does it mean to be canonized? Now, we're not going to look at it from all those multiple points of view. I don't think Steiner had much to say about Princess Diana or even Mother Teresa. We are going to look at how Rudolf Steiner defined and characterized sainthood. And I can tell you, it's nothing that you've heard before, it's probably nothing you're going to hear again. It is, due diligence, full disclosure, it's very esoteric. And if this sort of esoteric stuff is not your cup of tea, you can skip the next lecture. If you'd really like to know why we are working with the saints on the deepest level, then I urge you to listen to the lecture. But you're free. I have no way of tracking whether you're listening to it or not. I'm not affiliated with the NSA. And it's really up to you. All right, the next lecture, Who Were the Saints?